I've been invited along. It's really nice to be invited, and thanks very much for having me. As a part of a transition that's happened for a couple of years, as Sam and I have talked about the future of the University Fellowship of Christians, and the plan will be for us to move from, and Sam sent me an email about this a while ago, about how he'd been listening to a sermon by Mark Driscoll, an American pastor, who talked about different types of ministry, and how for many years Sam recognised that he was the one in charge for everything here, what Driscoll calls a decathlete. So Sam was kind of swimming and running and shooting and setting up everything as a part of the ministry, which is, in certain times and seasons, what you do with ministry. But he was looking forward to us working together as a golfing team, is the way Driscoll uses the metaphor. So two of us working together, contributing complementary gifts and works together. There'll be a lot more plaid next year, and there'll be a lot more sort of walking along the greens and putting, and these are all jokes, so you can have a little giggle if you like. So you can look forward to that next year. But it is exciting. I'll be taking on the main leading role within this ministry here. Sam will be working alongside me so that we can together achieve more with you as the student body, but also Sam will be continuing to work and invest in the Islamic evangelism that he does both here and other campuses around Australia. So I'm looking forward to that next year, and this is a really nice part of it for me. It gives me a taste of what the uni fellowship is like, and gets me a feel of who you are, and I can kind of close my eyes and picture where you meet, all that kind of thing's good. And I hope that some of the stuff that I'm saying, yeah, it will be relevant for now, for the rest of this semester. But I hope it's also relevant in us thinking about then, about next year, and where we're going and what we're doing and how we're going to get there. So I hope there's that kind of thing going on about it. Good on you for being here. As the semester moves on, you know, assignments are due, and somehow that it means it's impossible to come to something as important as a Christian gathering. But it's great that you are able to do the impossible, and even though you might have an assignment due or something one day, you're still able to come to Christian gatherings and to think deeply about the most important things in life, and to share together with others that kind of that scheming and thinking and praying and dreaming. So it's good to have you here, and I hope to see you here as well in the next couple of weeks as we keep looking at Titus. So have that open for you. It's a letter written by the Apostle Paul, one of Jesus' apostles, and it comes towards the end of the New Testament, and it is in some ways towards the end of the chronology of the New Testament. It's one of the books written to the next generation, with an eye to the next generation, not just what does it mean in the time of Jesus and Peter and Paul, but what does it mean after them? What's next? What does Christianity look like after Jesus and the apostles? Right up to today. It's a book that is very directly concerned with us and with our age and our time. And it's a book which is actually speaking to how the church will continue to be committed to God's mission in the world. So that's what we'll be looking at for 3 weeks. And this week particularly we look at leadership. And leadership is a vital part of mission. Now, I don't know what your church experiences are, but maybe sometimes it feels like it's the exact opposite, that leadership seems to be kind of put in place by the church to stop any mission happening. But it ought not to be that way. And when you open up the New Testament, what you find is that part of the missionary process is the appointing of leaders, that leaders are appointed to go out as missionaries. And so apostle means one who is sent. And leaders are not simply administrators of church organisation, but they are teachers and missionaries and evangelists. So you need leaders to begin mission often. But then to keep the missionary work going, you need to establish and appoint leaders, indigenous leaders, who will actually help the church to find its expression in a new part of the world, find its own identity and character, and work out what it means to faithfully serve God in that particular context. In history, that's often where missionaries have failed at times, is that they've failed to properly invest and identify and train indigenous leaders. And so you might have an explosion of conversion interest at the front end, but at the back end you have dissolution and a sort of Christianish mishmash kind of thing, just sort of mixed in together like one of those kind of juices you get from a juice bar. It's a bit of Christianity, a bit of wheatgrass, a bit of local pagan religion, all just kind of junked in together, and it's meant to be healthy, but it's, you know, it's appalling. Leadership is part of what is needed. It's an important part of what is needed in successful mission. You see an example of that in Acts chapter 14 and the missionary work of this man, the Apostle Paul himself. It might be helpful to go and have a look at that. With me. If you've got a Bible there, flick open to Acts chapter 14. And at the end of that chapter, you see how this guy who is covering a large amount of ground and doing a lot of work in terms of reaching new people and telling them about Jesus and who he is and what he's done. And yet he still sets aside the time to, well, look down at Acts chapter 14 verse 21. They preached the good news in that city, won a large number of disciples, and then they returned to Lystra, Iconium and Antioch, places they'd already been, strengthening the disciples, encouraging them to remain true to the faith, and, verse 23, Paul and Barnabas appointed elders for them in each church, elders or overseers or ministers or pastors. All those words are kind of used interchangeably in the New Testament, as we'll see as well in Titus chapter 1. Part of what some mission theorists call the Pauline cycle, the kind of the cycle of activity Paul did on his missions, identify that part of that cycle is the appointing of leaders who will then share together in the missionary work to reach out to appoint leaders. That's true of the church. The church needs leaders who share the sorts of things that Titus 1 speaks about. It's definitely true of the church. But it also, I think, ought to be true of the parachurch, the ministries that work alongside the church, such as the Muni Fellowship here on the Uni campus, that part of our successful work here at UTAS is not simply handing out a stack of flyers and then going home. It's not even simply holding a meeting and having a lot of people come in. It's not even having a lot of people come in and say, yeah, actually I'm persuaded, Jesus is Lord, I want to follow him. It's not even that. If we're not able to then establish those disciples and find leaders and recognise leaders, the whole thing is just an exercise in spectacle. And so an important thing is this, the thing Nathan mentioned, the AGM, part of which where you're voting for your student leaders. That's a really important thing. That's the step of actually identifying those amongst you who are going to help embody the leadership and commitment to mission here on this campus. It's a really big thing. And you don't just want to do it on the basis of, oh, I don't know, he's on the paper, tick. I guess I like him, tick. You know, you want to think, who are the student leaders who will? Well, let's have a look what. Titus chapter 1. We meet four leaders here, and the first of them is the Apostle Paul himself. Verse 1, he describes himself as a servant of God. In ancient letter writing, the from comes first. And so here, this is who wrote the letter. It's from Paul. And this man describes himself as a servant of God. His identity, first of all, is not Paul, one in whom is invested great hierarchical authority, or anything like this. Paul, one who has achieved this or that, or has this or that pedigree. Or there's no title even at first, but rather a low status. I'm a servant of God. That's who I am. Who am I first of all, first and foremost? How does he identify and see himself first of all? Not by his title, not by his role in some organisation, not by his reputation, but in relationship to God and with respect to God, one who serves God, who is attentive to God, who listens to what God says and seeks to follow his lead, who depends upon God for all things, who is in need of God's mercy. This is the man who can then go on to describe himself in verse 1 as an apostle of Jesus Christ. This is one who, along with the other 12 apostles of Jesus, shared this title, which in the New Testament, if we could do the study on that, in the New Testament carries the same kind of weight as prophet. Jesus, the great prophet, who comes and brings the message of God and who he is and an invitation for people to come to know God. And then his apostles are those who share that prophetic work of talking about Jesus. For a true prophet is one who speaks about Jesus. He is one who is worthy of great respect and is one with great authority. He is an apostle. And yet also, and primarily, he is a servant of God. This man serves God, and he serves it in this particular status as apostle, with a particular goal in mind at the end of verse 1. For the faith of God's elect, and the knowledge of the truth that leads to godliness. The first one is interesting for those who struggle with how exactly God's predestination and election can possibly relate to evangelism. Here in the mind of this man, the two fit together quite well. that God has his electing purposes, and then God appoints apostles to go out and find them. He's not a fatalist, even though he is one who has convictions about God's plans and purposes. He is committed to seeing those whom God has chosen saved by the message of Christ, and then he is committed to the imparting of certain truths that lead to godliness. So I want to see people saved, come to faith, come to follow the Lord Jesus and receive salvation from him. He wants to do that, and then he wants to impart this truth to them, this truth that leads to godliness. That is, Christian teaching is not simply a bunch of doctrines that you lay on people and get them to parrot back. But Christian doctrine is actually something that will have a profound effect upon the lives of those who receive it, if they actually receive it. It's a truth, a teaching that changes people. That's what chapter 2 verse 1 says. You must teach what is in accord with sound doctrine. If you get sound doctrine right, there are certain things that go along with it. There are certain behaviours and lifestyles and values and goals which fit with it. That implies, of course, there are also certain goals and values and behaviours and lifestyle that don't fit. It's a truth which ought to lead to godliness, and if it doesn't, then you doubt whether someone has really received that truth at all. So chapter 1 and verse 16 accuses certain would-be Christians that they claim to know God, they claim to have truth, but by their actions they deny him. If you have received the truth, it will be seen in your life. It's a truth which can be measured by the fact that it does have an impact upon life. All the way through this letter, the doctrine is called sound doctrine. It's hearty doctrine. It's healthy doctrine. It's good. And other teachings and ideas are shown to be false by their destructive effect. So, for example, again, these would-be teachers ruin whole households in verse 11. Amen. Who serves God in his role as apostle to see the conversion of people to the faith of Jesus Christ, see the establishing of people in the knowledge of Christ, which leads to a transformed life. And this is not just his little hobby. It's not just his kind of little bandwagon. You know, that some of the apostles, they might have been a bit more into kind of painting, you know. Other apostles, you know, they were particularly into doctrine and that was their little thing. Other apostles, it was kind of, you know, what it means to be a Christian surfer and that's what they were really into. And then Paul, well, you know, he was about the, you know, evangelization of the world and the proclamation of the gospel and the establishment. Yeah, and that was his thing and it's nice too, you know, and they each have, it's kind of like the Spice Girls or something, you know, you've got different spices and all that kind of thing or, you know, that kind of thing, or dance, you know, where each of them sort of comes out and, you know, I do tango and they spin around and then, you know, I do hip hop and they spin. They all spin around. Have you noticed that on dance? They just sort of come out and do a spin as if that's the hardest thing, you know. And anyway, and so it's just like that. Paul comes out and he goes, you know, I'm Paul and my dance is missionary work. You know, and he spins around or something, does the Pauline cycle. It's not that at all. But rather, he wants us to see that this faith, this knowledge, this mission that he is sharing in is something which is at the very centre of God's plans right across the span of everything. And so verse 2, it's a faith and knowledge resting on the hope of eternal life, which God, who does not lie, promised before the beginning of time, and has now brought to light through the preaching entrusted to me. This is the whole way of understanding the way the world fits together. The world is heading to an eternal life, the hope held out by the gospel. A hope which was prepared and planned for in the minds and purposes of God before the world, before there was light, before there was earth, before there was humanity. This was in God's mind and purpose and plan and intention. And it is now, in this age, in the age after Christ, that this is all geared up and happening. It's all unveiled, set to go. It is what God is doing in the world. It is where the world is headed. It is what the world is about. And everything else you do in your life You are just doing while being caught up in that great arrow, in that great plan and purpose of God. Everything else that you worry about and make sacrifices for and plan about and come up with different scenarios, A, B and C, and which one should I worry about the most. Every single thing that you study for and prepare for and write CVs for, every single thing that takes up your time and energy and imagination and money. All of those things, all the great and special experiences that happen in your life and all the savagely disappointing experiences that happen in your life are all just the things which are happening while you're on this road, while you're caught up in God's work in the world, promised before the beginning of time, heading to an eternity of joy or judgment. And now being put into effect through the proclamation of the gospel. That's the world we're living in. That's the world that he is sharing it in his role, but that's the world all of us are caught up in. The mission of the gospel is sharing in the work of God and the plan and purpose of God in the world. That kind of calling then writes to his son, Titus, verse 4, to Titus, this is the second letter we meet, to Titus, my true son in our common faith. Son here does not mean genealogical son, my literal son. As far as we know, Paul was never married. Titus is not his actual son, but rather his son in the faith. For central to Jesus' ministry and also to the ministry of Paul was the teaching and the nurturing and the entrusting of the craft of leadership and gospel proclamation to others. It wasn't just that he did his thing and others maybe looked on from a distance and kind of became his fan on Facebook. It's not just that he did his thing and then others can also subscribe and do a course or a seminar, which would be nice, and then maybe they could do the same thing. But that he actually took on a role of spiritual parenting in the lives of others. He actually took, and quite often in the way he wrote, he liked to talk this way about others who he'd brought under his influence and care and nurture to share his values and his mind and his purpose and his plans and his disappointments, to prepare for the future, so that at the end of his life he could write to someone like Titus and Timothy, another of his sons in the faith, and say, you know about my way of life, you know about what is important to me, and I want you to continue the family business. He was a mentor of others. One of the values of the Uni Fellowship of Christians has been ministry apprenticeships, and there's been who knows how many over the last 10, 11 years ministry apprentices here on the campus. And that's something that we ought to continue. And it looks like we'll have Alan Reeder coming on and joining as a ministry apprentice next year, which is very good and very fluoro green. And that is the way it ought to be. There ought to be a certain spiritual parenting going on in the life of ministries, the passing on to others. And it ought not just to be restricted to some sort of kind of hyper class of ministry apprentice or something. But really, that's kind of what all Christian conduct and ministry is about, is the nurturing of others, the investing in others. All leadership is about that. Those who will become members of the committee are not simply about making plans and writing minutes, but are about the nurturing of others. Not merely investing in one another, and the nurturing of others, the spiritual parenting of others. He and Paul both then share this common faith, this common vision, this common mission. And in the case of Titus, it seems like the dude is pretty tough. He's kind of dumped into Crete, verse 5. You in Crete was that you might straighten it all out. He's like the wolf who you just call up and say, we've got a mess here, can you come and straighten it all out? And he goes, I'll be right over. And then you just dump him in there and he'll tidy it up. He's one who is left there to just sort it all out in this situation, to set a pattern of ministry. So chapter 2 verse 15 tells him the kind of pattern he should be setting with all authority. And then he's to leave. Chapter 3 verse 12, as soon as I send Artemis and Tychicus to you, do your best to come to me at Nicopolis and we'll hang out for the winter there. Titus has a mission in Crete. He's to go in, tidy it up, and get out. And what's his mission? Well, central to it is leadership. And so the third leader we meet, we've met Paul, we've met Titus, Paul's son in the faith, and now we meet the people Titus is to appoint, the elders. We're told what the elders ought to be like. And basic to their kind of prerequisites is character. Not qualification, not charisma, not their kind of reputation in other fields of success or something, but is character. The big thing you want to be looking for as you think about appointing student leaders, even, is character. Not flair, not razzmatazz, not likeableness, not good looks, not fashionability, but character. You want to look for those with character. For a key part of leadership always is the setting of example. So much about what we learn really, at least what sticks, are the things that we see lived out and embodied. And these elders then are, in many ways, model Christians. They're set up to demonstrate what the Christian life should be like so that people can look at them and follow the example. That's what Titus is to do in chapter 2 verse 7. In everything, 2 verse 7, set an example by doing what is good. In your teaching, show integrity, seriousness, soundness of speech that cannot be condemned. And so here, the elders are to be, in verse 6, blameless in their family life. The husband of but one wife, verse 6, chapter 1, verse 6, a man whose children believe and are not open to the charge of being disobedient. Ones who are faithful as husbands. Ones who are able to be successful in their commitment to another. The most challenging and difficult, but also most primary relationship in which a human being can find themselves. And they are to be successful in their parenting. Of course, there is a sense in which everyone has free will, yes, and so children cannot be guaranteed just by the right parenting recipe to be raised, to be converted and perfectly behave. But there are basic ways of treating other people which can cause them to flourish, and there are basic ways of mistreating people which can cause them to flake. And so in looking for elders, you're looking for those who are faithful and diligent in their marriage relationship and who are successful in their parenting by nurturing and setting an example. The kids see that Christianity is attractive. It's real, it's deep, it's thoughtful, it's compelling, rather than sort of a little bit unreal, a little bit restricted and constipated and tired and like just like a fairy tale. But those who can show that it's a living, good thing, something that is lived out with consistency, all of this, something that in the other habits that the kids are taught as they're growing up, that they're able to lay hold of the gospel because they know how to just retain information and respond appropriately to authority and all these sorts of things. Blameless, capable, responsible leaders in their family lives. Now, what does that mean, really, for student ministry here on campus? It's a little bit difficult to kind of test someone's parenting skills, unless you want to kind of have a student committee made up of postgraduates, in which case we wouldn't ever get through a lecture, would we? Because every time we come in for a meeting, we just get the hands up all the time from the mature age student committee members would just go, oh, sorry, can I ask a question? Is this going to be an exam? And that kind of thing. And so that would just be horrific. So we won't do that. Since we can't do that, is there any relevance of this stuff to a student committee? Well, let me float something to you. At the very least, we could look for in potential student leaders, look for those who are successful in their home life with the responsibilities they do have. Are they able to hold their temper in dealing with parents who are always unreasonable when you have to live with parents? That is just part of how parents always will feel, is completely unreasonable and not understanding anything. Are they able to bear with that and still honour their folks? Are they, the kind of person who actually goes and replaces the milk when they use the last of the milk in the share house? Are they the person that can manage their credit card or is put in steps in order to manage their credit card, or is that out of control? Are they a person who can manage the basics of, being able to master those complex motor skills which involve buying a diary, and then the even more subtle and sophisticated ones which involve opening it and at the same time getting a pen, and then continuing on with this vast and challenging feat of gymnastics to then be able to write things in that diary and then be able to return to the diary at other times to check what those things were. But are they able to manage their responsibilities and their duties and their commitments so that they don't just kind of ride this sort of crazy wave of kind of overcommitment and dropping everything and kind of studying until 4 a.m. in the morning and then just sort of crashing and having to cancel things and forgetting things. And are they able to even control the email inbox? I don't even want to think about some of your email inboxes. You know, you can always tell once once you get past uni, to some extent I'm already suspicious of someone who only uses an @utas.edu.au email. That makes me a little wary of you. But what I hate is with people sort of more my age who still have the shared husband-wife email account. So it's mikeandnikki@yahoo.com. It's always Yahoo for some reason. And you know that person's email account is going to have, like, they have to invent new numbers to summarise how many emails are in the inbox of some people. It's just out of control, and some of them are kind of starred, and there's about 3 or 4 systems in there to kind of work it out, and Dan Brown is writing his next novel about the conspiracy theory of how to understand your email inbox. Are you able to control the commitments in your life, is what I'm saying? Whether it's information coming in, whether it's assignments that are coming out, whether it's commitments that you've made to your church, to your share house, to your family, are you able to hold all that together? They're the sorts of things you might look for. A leader is one who is blameless in verse 7 because their ministry is one that reflects on God. They are passing on God's work and God's message, and so therefore in a sense they're representing God. So, verse 7. An overseer is entrusted with God's work. He must be blameless, not overbearing, not quick-tempered, not giving to drunkenness, violence, dishonest gain. Control your passions and desires. How do potential leaders behave on the sports field and in traffic? How do they behave when things don't go their way? How do they treat those closest to them when in private and not in churchy scenes? How do you treat your siblings? How do you treat the waiting staff? What is your treatment of money? Are you that kind of person who's always trying to find the good deal a little bit dodgy, always trying to find see how you can maybe sell something back to someone and not be honest about, you know, actually how little it really cost you, that kind of person? You want to be wary, don't you, of the student leader who's always kind of, you know, spinning the good deal, who is really, and you know it, don't you, always drinking too much at the parties, even though they're your friend and it'll be weird to say anything. You know that they are. Or how are they just going at binging on World of Warcraft or some other sort of thing? Look, there's all sorts of things that we could just escape into, and there's fun, and then there's you know when it crosses the line, don't you? And you know when someone's just lost in a world of escapism. Well, how are they going in those areas? You want to look at that kind of stuff. Student ministry is killed by lack of self-control amongst students and student leaders. It's just killed by that kind of stuff. In its extreme forms, by students who can't maintain how much they drink, who they fall in love with, how to manage their assignments, can't control their temper and are embarrassment amongst their social circles. Kills the whole thing. And you can have the greatest looking flyers in the world and the most fantastic plans for mission, but if the students are just a bunch of rotters and hypocrites who just can't manage their own lives in accordance with what they believe and can't live out their lives in terms of their commitments and their relationships and their recreation in a way that actually has some sense to it, then of course the whole thing's going to be a joke. The thing that, it's a problem in Australia, it's a problem around the world when student ministry doesn't have Christians who realise that actually they became adults when they turned 18 and are still kind of behaving like kids. And in sometimes the church can enhance that, and you kind of get the youth leader who still calls you kids, you know, that kind of thing. And we kind of get bubbled into a little kind of ongoing, godly, nice kind of ongoing adolescence. When the need is for us to go, no, you're men and you're women and you're an academic institution, you are doing tertiary level training, some of you are playing with chemicals that could, like, you know, kind of create superheroes if you mix them the wrong way and, you know, let them get out of the laboratory. Some of you will be building bridges that if you build them badly are going to kill thousands of people. You're adults, you're grown-ups, you're living around people who are conducting adult sexual relationships, who are able to go into adult institutions, adult establishments and to drink and to drive and all that kind of stuff. You're grown-up people, and it's just death when a student ministry has its students and its leaders who are still kind of just behaving like kids when it comes to their faith and their mission. So don't. Verse 8, the leaders are to be those who are hospitable, self-controlled, upright, holy and disciplined, have an open home, an open life, who are not just absorbed in a world of church activity, but are open to others. Now, of course, it's scary. Christians are all nice and they like you. Non-Christians can be scary and not like you. But it would have been very nice for Christ to have stayed in heaven. It was nice there. It's not nice in this world that although he made it, it didn't recognize him. He came to seek and save that which is lost. A doctor doesn't hang around with healthy people who are much nicer to be around when you're a doctor. He hangs around with people in rashes in places that are embarrassing to talk about, because that's what a doctor is sent for the sick. And the same way, leaders ought to be those who are hospitable, who open their homes to those who smell and those who don't have the same morals and those who don't know what words you find offensive and those who aren't as nice and friendly and warm and conversational and chatty, but open to others. And of course, he closes with this, the upright, the disciplined, the holy, the self-controlled, someone who is in all of these things, being able to take the gospel and work it through their lives with God's help. The leaders are to have this Christian character, and finally, they are to fulfill a duty. What is called in verse 7, God's work, and what is unpacked in verse 9. God's work is not anything that is godly. God's work is not anything that's kind of loosely related to church, so kind of building a hospital in Nepal or something. God's work is not kind of being the representative Christian in a particular field of endeavour, as valuable as that is. But God's work, for as we saw in chapter 1 verses 1 to 3, God's agenda is the proclamation of the gospel. And so God's work in the world, his unique saving work, is the proclamation of truth. Verse 9, he must hold firmly to the trustworthy message as it has been taught, so that he may encourage others by sound doctrine and refute those who oppose it. Encourage and refute. Encourage. The task of the leader is to encourage with sound doctrine. Now that sounds completely contradictory, right? Encourage with sound doctrine. How depressing to sound dogma. I was really encouraged by all that dogma the other week. Gosh, I love catechism. It's just so encouraging. You know, when I'm feeling down, a little bit blue, I just sneak out the 39 articles and give them a bit of a read. It always cheers me up. Isn't that lovely? You know, I just love dwelling on the Latin phraseology and some of the older systematic works. You know, just to kind of give me a boost. You know what I'm saying? Is that good? You know, today I've got a little devotion for you guys. Okay, I just want to share, you know, Nathan shared a psalm for us last week and that was really nice. And this week I just want to just meditate on Simul Justus et Peccator with a little while and just unhand, you know, it's weird, isn't it? Encourage with sound doctrine. But whenever you hit something that seems weird, you should listen up, you should pay attention, you should go, hang on, mate, here's an opportunity for me to correct my thinking. Sound doctrine does encourage deeply. Deeply. It comes into the very fabric of the way you see the world, the way you think, the way you cope with life, the way you set your plans, the way you cope with disappointment. Sound doctrine deeply encourages in a way music just cannot. You know, when you go to church, it's great music and it's uplifting, and it's a 4-4 beat and it feels good in a just a kind of, I'm encouraged. I don't know what about really, but just encouraged. It was kind of Christian music, so I'm encouraged towards Christianity, I guess, to a 4-4 beat, and the music was loud. That was really encouraging, I guess, because I like loud music, so I was encouraged in that, I guess. That was nice. But there's not much to that, is there? The encouragement that comes just from an awesome praise band is... And it's more than just sentimental. I mean, I can encourage Nathan and go, I love your shoes. They're just really nice. I want to encourage you in your shoes. Or even just, you did a good job emceeing. I encourage you in how good you are at emceeing. And that's nice. And he walks away feeling kind of nice. It would be even nicer if I did a little cute card for him. You know, that would be lovely. With a little bird on the front with a button for an eye. That would be nice. But it's still pretty surface, isn't it? Whereas to open up the words of God to this world and to grasp them in greater depth about what God is doing in the world and who He is for those who would love Him and what He offers to those who have failed so desperately, to open that up and get the grip on that deeper and more fully has a profound encouragement that sustains you during the most rocky, violent, hurtful, painful times. That keeps you committed to things that are of value and that are noble and that have integrity rather than simply wasting your life. Understanding sound doctrine is far from irrelevant and boring and teachy and wordy and cerebral. It has a profound effect. Leaders, therefore, must encourage with sound doctrine, and they must refute also. Because sadly, it would be nice if all you could do is just say positive things and it would all work out, but it doesn't work out. Sadly, there are times when you need to directly refute, where you need to directly correct, argue against, debate, discuss, knock down. Truth is so good, error is so destructive. It's not enough to lead positively, but it is important to also be brave enough, and even as student leaders, to take on that kind of responsibility, to be brave enough when you come across error to name it, to pick it, to show it, to expose it. In love, yeah. Gently, yeah. Wisely, yeah. But to show it for what it is. Because truth is so good. Truth saves. Truth leads to godliness. Truth is the gift of God into a world that is lost in all sorts of lies and fantasies. And those lies and fantasies corrode and they take away hope. They take eyes off Christ and promise tacky things as a replacement. They take eyes off eternal life and promise mini blessings now instead. They take eyes away from what is good, even if it is hard to understand, and replace it with what is simple and easy and just not true. And so Titus is coming into Crete to make sure the church is established and settled in good things, the good things of God, so that from their leaders down to their rank and file, their members, they all share together serving God with integrity and handing out His gospel to a dying world. That's what He's been sent to do for the church. How much more then for us with a particular mission here at this university? To keep our eyes fixed on that and to fulfill that responsibility with zeal and with diligence, with integrity.